Amazing.
I saw this interesting thing on YouTube. I don't know if you know about it, but they put they had studies into the effect of the levels of income of employers, wages and everything. And they found out that up to a certain level, productivity, as you pay them more, the productivity actually increases. But once you get to a certain level, say like a CEO gets paid millions and millions of pounds, the productivity actually decreases, or you know, his input or her input or his creativity doesn't get better by the amount of money that is given to him. So what they found was that they rather than give them vast amount of money, they allowed them to say, like, 1 or 2 days a week, just go out and do some projects, you know, do whatever they're interested in, and work creatively within the organisation. And they found morale increased, productivity increased, etc., etc. Now, I was thinking, you know, within us socialist community, you know, people would be have the opportunity to work creatively with their fellow human beings to produce more, or for a certain goal, of course, and that would be a quite good good way of actually organising society, because we wouldn't have to worry about, oh, we have to get a job for a job's sake, for the mortgage, for, you know, any old job, be a carer, you know, I don't, you know, whether you care enough about the people that you're working with, you know, that's how you find, you know, lots of really disastrous outcomes for, you know, people in homes and people getting maltreated, and because the wages are so low, and they've got low self-esteem in the workers as well, you know. And that's what I found was quite interesting. Another thing is working in a low-paid job, not necessarily that low-paid, but quite a very structured way of working, is that you don't have any control, creative control, over your work activities, how to resolve problems. You're always referring it up the chain of command, can I do this? And you're very, very constrained, and it really, really breeds a lot of animosity, because, you know, you don't feel your opinions are considered fairly because who you are, basically, you're not. And so that's all I wanted to say.
Ah, in the nick of time. Dave, yeah.
Yeah. I was going to support Richard. I mean, I work in the manufacturing industry, and they've been introduced to us over the last 4 or 5 years, what Richard's been talking about, you know, trying to get rid of alienation out of the workplace, encouraging cooperation, teamwork. They're trying to de-hierarchize it and give people more control over the workplace and decisions that go on. Talking about, you know, creativity. There's nothing sort of like altruistic as far as the capitalists are concerned. Come back. They're doing it for obvious reasons, because, you know, it's been tried elsewhere and it's improved productivity. It's improved problem solving in the manufacturing process and stuff like that. And especially now in modern manufacturing, you can make a small mistake. Or somebody makes a small mistake, and it costs a hell of a lot of money. So it's really important that in the industry I work, which is quite, you know, capital intensive, high cash throughput, raw materials, mistakes aren't made, and the employees are really committed about what they're doing, you know, rather than just sort of watching some shit go down the line and not caring about it. We really have to get them on board and have to sort of, you know, make them feel sort of involved in what they're doing, which is what alienation isn't about.
Yeah, sorry.
Just to say, sort of following on from that point, it's, you know, a fairly standard socialist position that capitalism, its own way, is improving society in the sense that it's improving our capacities to produce things, to make life easier in various ways, to expand our capabilities. I think that's often framed in terms of, you know, look how many cars we can produce, things like that. It may also be that that sense of innovation in technology may also apply to interpersonal technology in the sense of ways of working with other people. It may be that in its own way, capitalism, through these various sort of workplace innovations, in terms of let's go or skydiving or whatever, you know, just to build our cooperation. Although obviously we all have a very cynical attitude towards that kind of thing, in its own way, what we might learn from that might help us in a future socialist society in terms of how people actually like to do things and, you know, what stimulates people to be creative. And I hesitate to use the word productive, but I suppose it's really the simplest one to use. I mean, obviously we don't want to have people considered as productive units for the greater socialist society, but, you know, we obviously want there to be plenty for us to enjoy as free individuals. So, just like a little spin on that kind of automatic cynicism that I felt as soon as Richard was talking about his lovely workplace that wanted to be in here.
If I could, just quickly, the team building, for want of a better word, sort of initiatives. I mean, one organisation I know, they've brought in something which looks similar to Facebook and has sort of some similar functions to Facebook. So, you know, you either within the organisation you work for or the other ones, you can sort of, you know, choose sort of friends as if you would on Facebook, but they're colleagues. So it's something which is supposed to sort of mirror the attraction we have for Facebook, because obviously it's something that takes up a lot of people's time and is a way of sort of socialising outside work. And ironically, Facebook is banned within work. You know, it's all blocked on our computers. But the organisations try to bring in something which is sort of a pale imitation of Facebook, because they see that as a way of sort of gelling people together. But of course, in that context, it's all very contrived, and it doesn't sort of flow naturally from what those workers or how they want to relate to each other. It's sort of thrown in from above, even if it is supposed to look like something like Facebook, which has sort of grown organically in some ways. I think that those kinds of gimmicks to gel people together are contrived, and I suppose work in a social society would include things that make it more pleasurable, sort of thrown in by whoever thinks about them, but they'll be more genuine because it takes place in different contexts, I think. Simon?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out with regards to, you know, what, you know, post-capitalist society might look like. I always hesitate to use the word socialism now, but it assumes it's this bubble, whereas it's not. What we're talking about is we are talking about everything that happens after the end of capitalism. Yeah? Capitalism is just a phase, and then there is however thousands or millions of years of human history before the sun dies that we have. That is what happens after capitalism, so I'd like not to call it something inside this box. Yeah? But if we're looking at life after capitalism, existentialists, when they're considering alienation, I say this for all existentialists, so I've read one or rather half of one, and maybe another one, I might have put a Wikipedia article or something, but all existentialists, have an approach where alienation is an absolute matter, if you sort of mean. It's the living of an inauthentic life. And an authentic life is something that is sort of like a dream to be attained. So sort of like you might sort of like, you know, just, you know, once or twice in your life, you might be like an arrow springing from a bow or something, and then that's it, you're done. But basically, the human life condition is to be inauthentic somehow, you know, less than. You know, somehow less than with yourself or whatever. I think we'll point out that sort of like getting rid of alienation is an entirely practical prospect. because all you're talking about is you're talking about a life where you are not constantly experiencing yourself as being small within your own world, as being removed from it. For example, when you're talking about production and work, there's no reason that just because you perform physical actions, you should feel alienated. Yeah? There's no reason that even if you're doing something for someone else, you should feel alienated. That has nothing to do with it. What it's to do with is the fact that the life that you are leading, yeah, the actions that you are performing, are those that turn against you. Yeah? Your actual things that you are doing are making you smaller, are diminishing you. And that is what alienation is all about. There is no reason that you have to have an economy that is based on this. Yeah? So you can have a life where you actually go about you go about your day as you will. Yeah? You agree with other people how you're going to live your life, but it doesn't have to be one that is constantly focused on. Well, you know what? We've got to stop enjoying ourselves. We've got to put enjoying ourselves over there, and we've got to put working over here. And now, you know what? We do 8 hours a day, and here we just do that. But is socialist because there's no bosses anymore? That's not what post-capitalist society should be about. It should be about we do what we think what we think enhances us as people. But yeah, we feel that we are more of ourselves at the end of the day because we have done the things that we have done. Yeah? It could be anything. And it is happenstance that we continue to live, you see what I mean? That all of the products that we need in order to survive have gone on. Yeah? That really, I suppose, is the definition of post-scarcity society, is that you're not constantly worrying about scarcity. You're not constantly having to turn yourself away from living and turn yourself towards the business of obtaining products. Yeah? Now, this is an entirely practical goal. A very small example of the kind of thing I'm talking about. Just bear with me for a moment. Stephen King, I don't know whether he was involved in producing this or endorsing it, but he came up with this typing tutor called The Typing of the Dead. Yeah? Now, what this is a game. Yeah? It's a game where you put zombies or whatever it is, yeah, something Stephen King horror-oriented. At the same time, you are learning to type. Yeah. But the point is that you are getting the product that you need, which is allowing yourself to know how to type. Yeah? But you are not experiencing the, oh God, I've got to sit in a room for 8 hours a day and someone's going to teach me how to type. Yeah? You are doing something that you want to do, and you can put any other skin over it that you like, to pretend that like you're playing pirates or something like that. And at the end of the day, you're acquiring the skill. So what I'm saying is that is a post-scarcity way of learning how to type. Yeah? You are learning how to type without ever having to reduce yourself to a thing that learns. Yeah? You're just doing... Now, what I'm saying is that if you apply that on a wider scale, there's no reason that you cannot go through your life, living your life, and at the same time produce all the products needed to be producing. Yeah? That, at the end of the day, that is a post-scarcity society. That is an unalienated life, but not in some sort of magical end of existentialism sense, just in that now we've solved capitalism problems and we go about our day sense.
Okay, we've still got time for more contributions, if you like. Feeding time is 12:30. Richard, you're next.
I've almost forgotten what I said. I was so intrigued with what Simon was saying. Which I was just wondering if somebody could actually have some way of putting the skin over reading Marx. I mean, especially sort of. I think I was just briefly going to pick up, I think, something that follow up from something that Bill said earlier. And that is that there's the sort of alienation that you feel and you experience. And then there's a sort of alienation that is somehow a little bit more objective that you can define, in the sense that Bill was saying that, you know, like when an employer actually uses us in order to use us better, finds ways of making us happier in the workplace, you know, for their own purposes, that also is a form of alienation. The kind of people that I was working with, obviously, were not actually feeling that; they were just feeling happier. I was more and more pissed off, you know, because I could see exactly what was happening and why it was happening. And I had quite a close relation with our HR department, and all these kind of happy clappy HR people I was saying, you know, sort of giving me all the latest management spiel about, you know, and how we're making much more productive workers, and isn't this wonderful by making them feel happy at the same time? You know? So I could see how that was it. So the more conscious you are, then obviously the more alienated you are going to be from that kind of practice. But for other people, you know, so they were just really kind of saying, I feel so privileged to work in a place like this. You know, that was what they were saying. But still, I still noticed that they were still fairly pissed off on Mondays when they came in from work. And the other thing I'd say about that experience was that it only occurred over a very short period of time. There is a kind of sense in which people norm, when that becomes the norm, then people still start to sort of feel, you know, what else is going on. And of course, what else is going on is the capitalist economy is going on, and we now have a recession, and a lot of those kind of practices are being withdrawn because, you know, when it's back to the tub thumping again, you know, sort of saying, get down, these are the jobs, you do what you're told. So capitalism can't sustain that, I think. That, I think, is quite an important issue. At least that's my experience of it.
Do you think that alongside the increase in alienation that you get in times of crisis, that also, in some respects, it helps to remove the scales from people's eyes a bit more, because it makes the relationships, the social relationships, more apparent, you know, more obvious. I'm just thinking about the comment that was made before about alienation historically, you know, in context of different modes of production, because in feudalism, obviously, your social position was fairly set, wasn't it, and you knew what you had to do, and there was no real, well, wasn't as much obfuscation about your role in life. And but capitalism, of course, develops many different means and new means of alienating us and atomizing us, whether it's in the workplace or without. So maybe the darkest hour is just before dawn. So as the crisis continues, sorry, anyway, who else? Anybody else would like to comment?
That's at that point, but yeah. I mean, that's the point about capitalism and its origins, isn't it? That it created legal freedom, it got rid of slavery, serfdom, and so forth. It created freedom for everybody, but then made us wage slaves. Mm-hmm. And it's that, just that existence of wage slavery and the relationship that creates with everybody else, that's the alienation. So capitalism steps there were quite positive in that sense and brought about a lot of possibilities for the future, but the limitations of what it can do.
John?
Yeah, me again. It's just a thought, school has been mentioned as kind of a beginning point of this hierarchical alienated existence. You know, the theme of the talk is alienation of work. So I was just wondering about post-capitalism, socialism, how you want to phrase it, the possibility of involving children in work. I mean, I'm also thinking of, you know, the kind of primitive communism, that the involvement of children from very early age, you know, in society as we live it from day to day, rather than having school where you go to for X number of years and then you leave that particular arena and arrive at your work. I have no, you know, real formed opinions on it, but just is there a sense of how we might approach that differently, maybe in a social society, less having this demarcation between when you're a child and when you're an adult, you know, when you have to learn and when you have to work.
Yeah, you're saying that. An example popped into my head. I think it was something that someone said at a summer school a year or so ago, that there's a someone's manufactured some sort of playground, like a roundabout or a seesaw, something like that, which at the same time that a kid uses it, then if it's a roundabout, it sort of pumps water out of a well, or the seesaw, the motion of the seesaw creates some kinetic energy.
Cruelty.
Well, within capitalism, that would be slave labour, but within a socialist society, you know, what difference does it make if you know, if you're on a seesaw and it helps pump a bit of water out of the ground? So yeah, I think that, that's maybe an example of where there would be some barriers broken down between what kids do and productive labour. But depending on context and how it's used, it could either be very exploitative or not exploitative. Well, depending on the context.
Kevin?
Second, did you want to go first?
No, thank you. Right. I was thinking of redrawing this, but I'm going to say anyway. I'm going to pick up on Dick's business about incentivising the worker, you know, give him more interesting things to do. I understand them. I'm just going down a memory road of nostalgia when I spent some time in the civil service, and I was one of the lowest grades of clerical life there. And I went to the civil service because I wanted to do something which I thought would be useful rather than get, because I'm never going to get into the sea, was I? So, there was a period in the civil service when they were actively looking at trying to get the workers, especially at the lower ranks, more involved in the job, because they knew they were essentially boring, for want of a better word, you know, repetitive filing, repetitive everything, you know, etc., etc. So they did it at a micro level where I was working at, but they were doing it at a more macro level as a department.
Right.
So the situation we was in is we all had a meeting, all with the team, and it was a bit like, it's from memory. We realised that many of you here are intelligent people, and we want to be able to stretch you, give you more demanding work to do, to get you out of your comfort zone, you know, all this stuff. So I thought to myself, comfort zone. That's something I'm comfortable in. Why would I want to move outside of it? I'm quite happy there, you know. Stretching me. That's interesting. And I thought, well, if you stretch an elastic band to a certain point, it's going to snap. And I don't want to snap because I've been doing something which is more demanding. So I didn't say very much. And everyone's joining in and trying to find out what other people are doing. And do you want to do a bit of my job this week? And I found my job was one of the lower jobs. No one higher up want to do a bit of my job. But I were quite keen on that. Then I went to the big one, the forum, where lots of the workers in the Department of Health, and the same story was going on. We've got Edmund here. Let me do my black other. We've got Edmund here, and he's a very nice guy. He's come out of university. He's doing this job, which we know he could do a bit more. So we've set Edmund a load of quite a few tasks. And we're really pleased to say that Edmund has taken these tasks on. He feels so much happier about going to work, etc., etc. And you, that's right, isn't it, Edmund? And Edmund says yes, and, you know. So this is going on, and people were saying, oh, you know, this is good, man. So I waited my time, and I said, excuse me. I forget what the woman's name was, Gretchen or whatever, I don't know, or Brendel. So I said, I'm very interested in this. I said, I'm really pleased that you've taken up these initiatives to get Edmund the chance to show what he can do. So I said, you've not mentioned any rewards Edmund's got for this. Did you pay him to do more of this work? Silence. There's nothing going to be said now. Because, of course, they don't want to pay him more money. They want him to get to do more work. And we're not paying him. So, what's the moral of this story? But the point about incentivising people is they're only doing it on their terms, when it suits them.
That is capitalism.
Yeah.
There's three more with hands up, and then after that, maybe Mike want to sum up.
Unless,
Mr. Hugh,
want to sum up.
So first it was Rob, then Vince, then yourself. So Rob, yeah.
No, I finished. Thank you. Make sure. I want to come back to the analogy that Mike was making about the
Seesaw.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the water cooler.
Sorry, Rob. Can you speak up a bit?
Sorry, the analogy of the people around the water cooler, the office of politics. I try, I'm working in the public sector, I try to let it go across my head as much as I can, but most of what I hear going on in the office is people commenting upon the way the work's organised and the fact that especially the people near the bottom of the food chain at work, they seem to have a better idea of how the work should be organised than the people near the top of it. And there seems to be a constant amazement in their eyes that things aren't done in order to most efficiently run the organisation from the point of view of certain what they see as the objectives of the organisation, i.e. in the delivering a service to the people, to the customers. But they don't seem to see that that isn't the actual aim of the organisation, in that the aim of the organisation is to turn a profit in, not in the case of selling widgets or so, it's that the organisation, it's damping down on the costs of the capital class. And it just seems that there is a huge lack of class consciousness, and that if we could build this more of a sense of class consciousness in people's outlooks, that you know their productive capacities would be hugely increased in actually taking control of workplaces and their own lives and overturning this alienation.
Vince?
Yeah. Looking around at the people in this meeting today, I'm sure that there are many of U3A age, the University of the Third Age, and I just quote this organisation as an example of what can be achieved when people act in a cooperative way. Obviously, it's organised under in the capitalist system that we live in. But having said that, and obviously bearing that in mind, there are many cooperative aspects. Now, some of the groups in the U3A are involved in leisure time activities, but you could describe that work and education. Then there are things like IT, which is obviously related to the world of work as well as hobbies. Languages as well, those two categories are hobbies and work in general. And the point is, although there are group leaders, they are not leaders in the sense the SBGB talks about. They're merely organisers. But it's the cooperation that interests me, and also you feel that when you go along to these meetings for different subjects, you're learning things and doing and working to a certain degree as well. It's a totally different feeling that you get in comparison with the world of employment, where obviously, as we've been saying today and on many other occasions, people know that their livelihoods depend on performing to the expectations of the management hierarchy in capitalist enterprise. In the U3A, it's still within capitalism, as I've already said. There is the people are not earning money from what they're doing. They're doing things that they enjoy, where money is not really a consideration. Their money is in capitalism. But I'm mentioning this because I think, at least in part, there's the type of ethos towards learning, education, and work in the UVA, limited though it is, but it's the type of ethos that we have about those three areas in socialist society.
Okay, Pietro?
My intervention relates to this, and scream an opinion to this question about kids at work. I think that in a different society, you know, we would have to go through the money relationship. So work would be different. So, for example, when there is this kind of events like cleaning up the riverbanks. She do it voluntarily, with along with friends, other people. You are doing a work. You are working, but you don't feel at work because you do it spontaneously. And you might be a kid and you sit down, eat sandwiches, it's everything different. And so, if we take away the money from the aquarium, would be different. Kids like to be near adults and be part of the adults' world and be seen as useful. So I think if you think of work as it is now, then there are questions. Put a kid working in a factory when he's 10 years old, probably it's not very good. But in another kind of society, probably it would change completely. So we you have to go beyond that. What we see now, that's what
excuse me, I need to put that out.
Anybody got any last contributions? Anything you'd like to comment on? Any fashion tips or recipes? Knitting patterns? That sort of thing. Otherwise, maybe give Mike a chance to wrap up.
I'll just take a couple of minutes to remind us of some of the interesting points that came up in the discussion, especially bits which, when I heard them when raising the discussion, I think, oh, I should have included that, or I wish I'd thought of that myself. So I've got some films to watch as well. So thanks for the suggestions of some other films, and hopefully a few of us will look out for those. And I think a couple of things I didn't think about when I put the talk together was the point made about what happens when you lose your job, and all these. Even if you're alienated at work within some, rigid structure that is soul-destroying, what happens when that's suddenly ripped away from you when you reach retirement age or you lose your job, and, that comes with other costs as well. So you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't in capitalism in that way. And I think another point was raised, which I found very interesting, again, I wish I'd thought of it myself, was the way that that happy work places, especially ones where sort of gimmicky type techniques have worked, are more alienated as the workers sort of accept their situation more and maybe sort of less able to pick out the faults or the problems inherent in the workplace. So alongside that, the more conscious you are of alienation, the more it can get to you as you recognise the faults. So yeah, I think there were some valuable points made, and also as well about hierarchies and. Something which I thought was Rob was going to raise, and I'm not quite sure if it was his point or not, about how those at the bottom of the corporate ladder are more able to make suggestions about ways of improving things because they're on the front line and they have to deal with things day in, day out. And of course, those at the top of the corporate ladder, they're sort of removed from the situation, and so they're usually less able to see what actually needs to be done in terms of sort of practical improvements. But of course, the people most removed from the situation are the ones with the most authority to make the decisions. So that's another sort of aspect of alienation, another way that that hierarchies pull people apart, in that those who make most of the decisions are less able to see how things should really be done. So thanks very much for the contributions and the discussion afterwards, because it's raised a lot of interesting points which I didn't cover myself. So thank you very much.
Thanks, mate. Right, slight change to this, sorry for the programme. It says 12:30 lunch. It's actually dinner, not lunch. I'm from the north. It's dinner. Okay. But anyway, the good news is it's feeding time at 12:30. So you can run free and wild for a while.